And it's a good afternoon to you, Lagos. Again, I know I'm back. You hear me twice. Yes, that's what you do. You get the pleasure of hearing me twice in one day. Have you all ever wondered what I do in the 2 hours between my two shows? I'll tell you another time because there's no time to waste. I have with me a special guest. He actually has a very special name. You Nigerians will get all excited about his surname. I know what you're like. Okay, you know how we do on Borderlines, the only show that takes you beyond borders, right? You send a WhatsApp message where there's a chance I will open up the lines, but he's my guest first before I share him with you. 0809-597-5805. So what am I talking about today? Today we're going to three borders. Yes, I said three. We're going first, we land in South Sudan. Yes, you're thinking South Sudan. She's talking about South Sudan. You've heard it. You're not quite sure. You're getting it mixed up with Sudan. Mm-mm. There's a whole lot going on in South Sudan. And as you know, Borderlines is about educating and empowering with information. We go everywhere. My special guest, where we're landing first, is writer and researcher. He's a lot more than that, but you know, they like to keep it short when they're experts. Joshua Craze. Yes, I said Craze. I'm not being rude. That is his name. Because I know you Nigerians be saying, why are you being rude about the guest? I am not being rude. That is his name. Joshua is a writer with over a decade of experience doing research in Sudan and South Sudan. He has worked in the two countries for the Small Arms Survey and Human Rights Watch. He's also worked for the Center for Humanitarian Dialogue and the United Nations Mission in South Sudan. So you see, on Borderlines, we get experts. He's joining me. Where are you joining from, Joshua? From the States?
Yeah, from the States.
Where?
Upstate New York.
Cold.
In the tree.
Cold.
Yeah, horrible.
Ouch.
Take me away.
Which part? I was in Fairfield many years ago. Call me unlucky.
Yeah, exactly. Sorry about that.
Thank you so much for joining us. South Sudan, and you are the expert, if I may say so. Nigerians, my people, wherever you're joining from, stay listening because you're going to learn a heck of a lot. So Joshua, as you heard me say earlier in my introduction, most people have heard of Sudan. Most don't think of South Sudan. They still think, you know, of the whole of Sudan, the Central African country called Sudan. Most don't remember or don't realize that South Sudan broke up from Sudan in 2011. Most don't realize that South Sudan is an independent country. Most are not aware that Sudan in itself, yes, was ruled by Egypt at some point. And Sudan got independence in 1956. I hope you're all making notes. And there's been several, trust me, I hope they're making notes. I know my listeners, honestly, they can be judge and jury. But the thing about interesting, the really interesting thing about that region is the number of civil wars that has happened. So I'm going to hand over to you. Tell us about the breakup from like 1972 when South Sudan said, nah, I don't want to be part of you anymore.
So if I can give your listeners a little bit more history.
Go ahead.
And we go back even to the 19th century.
But excellent. Yes, go ahead.
What was southern Sudan for Khartoum, for Sudan, the Sudanese capital? It was an area for extraction of resources. Mm. It was a place that people took slaves from. And those that we're talking about, the Turks, the Egyptians, there's a series, and the British, of colonial regimes that treat the South as just an area of extraction, exploitation. And the first civil war begins the year before Sudan even becomes independent.
Mm-hmm.
So from the very beginning, the ruling elite who then take over when Sudan gets its independence in 1956 from the Anglo-Egyptians, that elite make it clear that they're going to continue the same system.
Right.
They're going to exploit the South in just the same way. And the South goes, hell no, we're not going to do this. So they begin a revolt from 1955 that lasts all the way to 1972. And then there's this brief period of 10 years, almost like hope, when the North say, look, the South, rule yourselves to some degree.
Mm-hmm.
We will invest in the country. We will develop the peripheries of the country. But then largely because of a debt crisis created partly by international financial institutions, Nimeiri's regime, so the regime that runs Khartoum, mm-hmm. pulls out of the South and instead makes an alliance with a group of Islamists. And there we have another colonial legacy, which is that the north of the country was largely Islamic, but the British forbade the Islamists from going south.
Right.
And instead introduced missionaries. So you have often a south which is quite Christian, mm-hmm. or quite, you know, based in indigenous beliefs. And this became a really problematic issue in the 1980s and led to the beginning of the war. And you had this formation of the SPLM, which is currently South Sudan's ruling party. This is 1983.
Mm-hmm.
And they were at the beginning, they're a Marxist party. And they don't want the independence of South Sudan.
Right.
They want revolution in Khartoum. They say, look, this sucks. Why is Khartoum exploiting the whole of the rest of the country?
Mm.
Why is it a center that's dominating everywhere? We don't just want rights for the southerners, but also for the people in Darfur, also the people in East Sudan. So they begin this war, and John Garang, who's this very charismatic figure, is one of the few figures who really has pan-Sudanese appeal. And they fight for 20 years in the bush.
Wow.
They never, like, initially with backing from Ethiopia and the Derish regime, but when the Derish regime in Ethiopia falls, so when communism basically goes into crisis, they switch again and they try to reformulate themselves. And unfortunately, what happens, and this sows the seeds of the later crisis in South Sudan, is that Bashir, who's the dictator in Khartoum, he doesn't fight the war using the army. He does what colonial regimes have done in Sudan for 100 years. He hires local militias. He intensifies ethnic divisions in the south. So most of the forces that he hires, he gives weapons to, promises positions to, come from the Nuer, who are South Sudan's second largest ethnic group. And they fight against the people of John Garang, who are from the Dinka, which is South Sudan's largest ethnic group. Bear in mind, there's more than 100 ethnic groups. I mean, Nigeria can understand.
Oh, totally.
How complicated these tapestries can be, right?
Yes.
So, but this sows this real bad blood between the Nuer and the Dinka, because they're fighting, and the Nuer are fighting on behalf of this government in the north. And this war is going on for 20 years. There's starvation, there's depopulation, there's both sides exploiting humanitarian actors, and things really change because of 9/11.
Ah, tell us.
Internationally. Because before Bin Laden set up home in Afghanistan, where was he living? He was living in Khartoum.
Right.
Which didn't look too good for Bashir. Bashir was like, that guy's got to go. All of his guys got to go. Let's get him out. Right? Because he's suddenly worried. He's looking at Afghanistan and Iraq. He's going,
I don't want the Americans near me.
You know? So he starts having this close relationship with the CIA. Stella Ghosh, his chief win is like the same year that America decides that there's been a genocide in Darfur, orchestrated partly by the head of intelligence, head of Sudanese intelligence, Salah Ghosh. The CIA go, yo, my homeboy, and bring him to DC for a meeting. So they, on the one hand, like Colin Powell's going, there's been a genocide because there's another war in Darfur.
Mm.
Another peripheral people rising up against the racist dominating central regime in Khartoum. And the Americans are going, well, but if you help us get Bin Laden, it's okay. Don't worry about that. We'll bring him to DC.
Mm.
Right? But they do put pressure on Bashir to say, okay, look, why don't we have an independent South Sudan? You come to the table, just give it away. This isn't what the SPLM fought for, but it is now what's on the table.
So it's the Americans that suggested it, that breakup.
So the Americans were a big part of why it became possible. It was always, in South Sudan, a contested issue. The real SPLM vision
right.
was a new country. But there were always those, especially weirdly among the Nuer, who said, nah, these Arabs, this Jalaba, forget about them. We want to do our own thing. So it was always an active question of debate among South Sudanese intellectuals. But it was impossible diplomatically, and this is Bush, remember, to have a new Sudan as a diplomatic thing. We can't have another invasion. But a low-hanging fruit, like to chalk up as a win against the failures of Afghanistan and Iraq, is an independent South Sudan. So they came up with this agreement. Now, you've got to remember, there are wars at this moment, in 2003 to 2005. There's a war in Darfur in the west of the country.
Mm-hmm.
There's a war in the south fought by the SPLM. But the SPLM were also fighting in Blue Nile, South Kordofan, these other areas with largely non-Arab populations who want the chance of self-governance. An American goes, nah, let's leave those guys aside. We're going to focus on the south because they have this whole story. The south are Christians. True somewhat, but there's a lot of Muslims in the south. The south have been enslaved. Little bit true, mainly false, right? But they have this narrative. It's a very American narrative, and they're going to free the south. So all these other stories, South Kordofan, Blue Nile, Darfur, they get forgotten. When, in the end, South Sudan votes for secession in 2011, what immediately happens in Blue Nile, South Kordofan? They go back to war. So all this peace agreement did, because it didn't address, it was called the Comprehensive Peace Agreement. And the joke was, in 2005, it wasn't comprehensive. It wasn't peaceful. And no one agreed about it. So this is what happened, right? Like, the war continued.
Yes.
Abyei, the area of Abyei, which we've seen fighting in the last couple of weeks, did not get its referendum. South Kordofan and Blue Nile didn't get their representation. They got marginalized. Darfur continued its war. In fact, the war in Darfur intensified. So really, this was a way, you know, like often the international community, so-called, they take the easy bit.
Yeah.
They play it, the public relations exercise, and they're like, great, and now we're done. But then the wars break out all through Sudan the moment South Sudan becomes independent. And we got to remember that when South Sudan in 2005, when peace comes, you've got the SPLM, this party under Garang, and then you've got all these newer militias, these forces that have been sponsored by Khartoum. Now, Salva Kiir becomes the president when Garang, this very charismatic leader, dies mysteriously in a helicopter accident in Uganda. Kiir is a dinka man. He's a soldier.
Ah.
He's still the president. He's not a charismatic figure. He cannot carry the north. And what he does is he looks at all these newer militias and he thinks, whoa, they're a bigger armed force than we are. They might disrupt this referendum on independence. And Salva Kiir really wants independence. So Salva buys them off. He does exactly what Bashir did. He's like, guys, I will give you money in exchange for your guns. So he basically buys a peace, and that peace lasts through independence in 2011. But by 2013, the oil revenues are plummeting. There's greater contestations for power, and they've built a state, which is basically a state based, if we're honest, on corruption.
So,
it's based on taking... Yeah.
Go ahead. Finish your sentence.
It's based on taking oil revenue, which they're now getting. Oil was found in the 80s, but didn't flow to South Sudan until 2005. And they distribute it to different politicians to try to keep this coalition together. But when the oil revenues crashed, the coalition broke up. And it broke up on ethnic lines. And in 2013, that war between the Nuer and the Dinka basically restarted. And it started off largely as a war between those old Nuer commanders, and it used to be under a general called Pilunu Matiep, against Salva. But it soon devolved into this internecine conflict between all the ethnic groups in South Sudan. We haven't even got to, there's the Equatorians in the south, which are groups which are much closer to Uganda and Kenya. They're not pastoralists, they're agriculturalists. They're like, what about us? The Nuer, the Dinka, these are all pastoralist groups. They begin their own revolution.
Wow.
So it gets very complicated, and I could talk for hours about this.
And I would love to talk to you for hours. Honestly, Lagos, Nigeria, I know many of you listen to us abroad. I told you you're in for an education, didn't I? Borderlines. I hope you were taking notes, right? Joshua usually comes very expensive, but he came to us free of charge. Wow, there's so much. And look, here's the thing. Let me just tell everybody, you do know it's Black History Month, right? Lagos, Nigeria, wherever you're listening from. Yes, Black History Month. And he's just giving us a snippet of all some of the issues that's going on in Africa. When people, Joshua, when people talk about the South Sudanese crisis, I'm still calling it crisis, you can correct me and tell me what word we should be using for it. I'm very careful to call it crisis. When people talk about, when they talk about the crisis, they do talk about it like it's so incredibly complicated because it is an internal crisis, right? So you've got the current president, Salva Mayaditi, or how do you pronounce it? Mayadit. And then you've got his former deputy. And they're both, I mean, it's literally like horror movie. It's like, you know, two brothers fighting, mom and dad fighting. They're both at each other's neck. What happened with those two that actually led us to where we are today? So let's start with their relationship and how that broke down, and then we'll come forward.
Sure. So this has to go back to the 1990s.
Mm-hmm.
And in the 90s, as I said, when the Ethiopian regime, which was giving rear supply bases and ammunition to the SPLM, the main rebel group in the south, when that broke down, there were two big charismatic commanders in the SPLM who weren't Dinka. There was Riek Machar, who is the deputy of Salva, who is a very charismatic gap-tooth guy with a PhD in engineering, very, very smart. And there's Lamakol, who is from the Shilluk. And they are two of the commanders that split inside the SPLM. So at the beginning in the 1990s, there was this split between largely Dinka forces, but not entirely, and Noor and Shilluk forces. And I'm simplifying because there's a lot of different commanders involved.
Of course.
But one of the things that happened was something called the Bor Massacre, where the forces under Riek Machar went to a place called Bor, which is where John Garang is from, that very charismatic leader,
mm-hmm.
and massacred thousands of Dinka civilians. And that was never really forgotten. What happened was that Machar ended up taking money from Bashir, the dictator in the north, and though he claimed that he was for the independence of South Sudan against Garang, he was really a vessel for the northern colonial power to continue to oppress the south. Until finally, his campaign collapsed and he rejoined the SPLM. And when finally the country becomes independent, you've got, on the one hand, this kind of dour, very, very smart Dinka commander, Salva Kiir, from Western Barakazal, from the west of the country, west center of the country. And you've got Riek Machar, he's much more charismatic, much funnier, beloved by the international community, deputy, who is the spokesperson of the Noor. And these become the sort of the main two vessels for different types of ethnic nationalism. And Salva gets increasingly paranoid that Riek is going to say, okay, you've shown us through independence. Now it's my turn.
Mm.
And that, for a lot of the Dinka business and political elite, is like, nah. Like, there could be many people after Salva. It will not be this man. And this becomes this big split. So in 2013, after they've turned off the oil, there's a way to get back at the north, and I can come back to why that happened. He dismisses Riek from his cabinet, and then he dismisses, the Salva does, his entire cabinet. And so you kind of know war is coming. Everyone knows war is coming, apart from the UN, because they never know anything, but we can also talk about that. And so finally, when this little spark happens, the disagreement inside J1, which is like the presidential palace in Juba, and Riek runs for his life, and he's joined by all the newer commanders who used to be a part of this opposition group, the SSPA, this army under Mete. And that becomes the war initially. Really, it's a Noor Dinka war between these commanders that fought against each other during the Second Civil War. Now, there was one peace agreement in 2016. Let's leave that aside. We don't want your listeners' heads to explode. But we get to the agreement of 2018. Riek comes back into government. He's the vice president again under this peace agreement.
Mm.
This time it's different because Riek is powerless. He's basically a captive. He's a housebound hostage in Juba, the country's capital. He can appoint ministers, certain ministers, but they don't have very much power.
Mm.
The power is all really with the politicians around Salva. And the other Nuer politicians, they see this and they desert Riek in droves. So Riek Machar, the vice president, still has a few people loyal to him, but largely everyone has either gone into opposition against Machar or they've joined the government. Now, you might think, okay, in a way, that should produce peace. But weirdly, though there's been a peace agreement since 2018, the country is more violent now
than they ever
than was during the war.
Yes, and this is the thing. People do say the peace agreements didn't work, as you've often said. Now, let's talk, and this is also the other really saddened thing about it, that it's a tribal war. It's a tribal war, and innocent people are caught up in it. Some 2 to 4 million people have been displaced. Several thousands have died, etc., etc. Does Salva Kiir still really has any power? Can he control what's going on the ground? Or do the other factions, because obviously other militias and stuff have gotten involved, can they overpower him?
He does control to a great extent what's happening. And I'd say it's not so much tribal as it is political.
Okay.
And what politicians do is they use ethnic differences to wage war.
Oh, stop. You just spoke to Nigeria. What? Every Nigerian that's listening right now, they're thinking, oh my God, he must have been in Nigeria with us. The telephone number is 0809-597-5805. Joshua, just say that again, please.
It's not so much a tribal war as it's a political war, and politicians use ethnicity to further their own campaigns.
Absolutely.
Right? And the number one politician who does that, unfortunately, is Salva Kiir. And the way he does it is smart. Is that he uses ethnic divisions to separate groups and set them against each other.
Mm.
So if you look at a place, I'll give you listeners one place. It's a state called Upper Nile. It's very complicated. But you've got three main populations, right? You've got your Dinka, your Nuer, and the Shilluk. And the Shilluk have been ethnically cleansed off their land by the Dinka. But you have people inside all three groups. They're all supported by the government. They're all loyal to Salva Kiir, the president. But Salva knows they all hate each other and so can arm them to fight each other. And he will sponsor different sides against each other. So in 2022, you have a war in which he sponsors rebel groups, rebels, not part of the army, to fight against other rebels, also not part of the army, who are in theory part of Machar's forces, to fight each other, because then they weaken each other and they strengthen the center. And to put on my academic hat for a moment, what I've called this is centralized fragmentation. You make the center stronger by making the rest of the country weaker. So there used to be, for instance, the SPLM was the political party, and whatever you said about it, it was a strong institution. And under this peace agreement, it's been radically weakened. Now the SPLM is just called the party of whatever Salva Kiir wants it to be. There's no sense of an independent party that can put a check on executive power. Because weirdly, this peace agreement, which follows all of these sort of peace agreements, is a form of dictatorship. Because all the positions in the country, and we're talking down to county commissioners, are chosen by Juba, by the capital.
Wow.
There's no voting, there's no local legitimacy. So what Salva does is he will appoint these very violent commanders to be county commissioners. And they will be weak if you think about, like, they have no, like, local support, no local legitimacy. But they're strong because they get guns, money, and positions from Juba. And this is the sort of fragmentation that happens. And so then, in order to get support, what do? They turn on rivals. And it's not just tribes. It's not just ethnic groups now. It's even down to the level of sections. So if you think about the pastoralist groups, like the Nuer and Dinka, you have the Dinka, for instance, are divided up into a series of different. There's the Bor Dinka in an area called Bor. Then there's the Badang Dinka. But the Badang themselves are divided up into different sections.
Good God.
And sometimes it's those sections that fight against each other. So the Nuer, for instance, one of the sections that a lot of the commanders come from are called the Bul. And the Bul live in Mayom. And in Mayom, there's like 12 different sections among the Bul. And within each of those sections, there's another four or five sections. And those sections are fighting often for pieces of land on which they can graze cattle, which are tiny. And this sort of like intersectional fighting has increased massively, in part because of the project of the state. Because the state has said, let's demarcate all the territory. But this sort of grazing, this flexible form of life, you can't have absolutely demarcated territories. Because this territory needs to be flexible because of rainfall, right? Because of when the dry season and the rainy season is. And so because of the state itself, you found suddenly these politicians coming and going, I'm going to get you the best demarcation. I'm going to maximize your land. Let's displace those guys. And so like the politics of the state has reached down to the local level.
Absolutely.
Massive amounts of violence.
Yes, really quite shocking. So one of the things that happens in war is child soldiers. From what I'm hearing, it would appear Salva Kiir, with his divisionary tactics, is also using child soldiers. Am I correct?
Yeah. So what's a child? You know, I mean,
good question.
The SPLM has a long history of using child soldiers. During the war, it was called the Red Army.
Ah.
It was an army of children. And they went to get trained in Ethiopia, and then they came back. Carol Berger has a whole book that she published recently about it. In the full army now, which is now renamed the SSPDF, there are less child soldiers. I wouldn't say none, but there are less. But a lot of the forces now doing the fighting are ethnically organized local militia forces. And there's a lot of children. If we're talking about 16-year-olds, 15-year-olds currently fighting. On the other hand, I wouldn't demonize this too quickly, because a lot of the people that I know are young boys who are fighting, because it's the only opportunity they have available to work.
That was the other thing I was going to actually ask is, you know, you have an average age of what, 18?
Yeah.
So now what you're saying is the majority of these 18-year-olds are pretty much just soldiers.
I wouldn't say the majority, but that is one of the ways that you can get through. If you go to a place like Warap, which is where Salva's from, there's a lot of fighting between factions and people join cattle camps. And in those cattle camps, they look after cows, largely for big politicians. Mm. And then they go raiding from other groups. And that, like, there's been a total collapse of the economy. Government jobs haven't kept rise with inflation. So they basically, you know, like the wage of a policeman will not pay for a family for a day, let alone a month.
Wow.
When it gets paid, right? Like a policeman's wage could be 4,000 SSP.
Which is how much in dollars, roughly?
$2. Which is the price of a kilogram of meat.
Wow.
So that's for a month when it gets paid. And maybe you only get paid half the months of the year. So really, the question there is, what are you going to do? Well, one of the avenues is to raid, right? Or to become a militia soldier. Another is to join an NGO. But the NGO jobs aren't there. Humanitarian support has dried up because donors are racist and they think Ukraine's more important. And so
I'm glad you mentioned it.
Collapse in the humanitarian economy. And so really, either you're going to sit at home, you know, drinking tea and doing a bit of farming, but really the farming economy has collapsed because you've had, in some parts of the country, year on year, historically bad flooding. Right? So the farming land is underwater. The cattle are dead. There is no government economy. There's no private economy. What are you going to do?
Indeed, what are you going to do?
You know?
International community. So first and foremost, I'm curious, who's backing Salva Kiir? Because he's got to either have what? Russia, M23, US, EU. I don't think it's France, because I don't think they go that far. So who is backing, which international country government is backing Salva Kiir?
So if you go back to 2005, when you have the peace agreement,
and he's wearing that hat.
He's wearing, well, he got that hat from George Bush, mm-hmm. right? Because he's like, it's a cowboy hat and he mm-hmm. likes being a cowboy. Mm. There are also cowboys, you know, there are cattle keepers among the Dinka. They have a huge amount of international support from the Norwegians, who historically have a big role in humanitarianism in Sudan, the English and the Americans. There's a lot of donor money. I mean, we're talking billions of dollars going into the country from 2005, 2011. There's a lot of international assistance to create financial institutions that largely turns a blind eye to a lot of forms of corruption and kleptocracy, and a lot of money leaving the country into bank accounts in Nairobi, houses in Australia,
World Bank,
because they think something's going to be built, but they're not that serious, I think, about really understanding the country, because what the country actually does is have a continuation of the warlord economy that existed during the Second Civil War, which is 1983 to 2005. During that time, commanders like Mashar, Salva, they displace people, they build up large herds, they exploit humanitarian resources. In 2005, when the oil taps turn on and the donor money starts coming in, they swap out guns and humanitarian resources for oil and donor funds.
Wow.
But basically, from the beginning, and here again is a story I think some parts of Nigeria might know.
Of course.
That elite is autonomous from society because they're not getting money from taxes. They're not getting money from their people. They're getting money from selling the resources of the country abroad and from getting money abroad. So why should they care about schools or health clinics, right? Because money's not coming from there.
Yeah. They don't. There's no. So basically what you're saying is there's no investment in any kind of strong civic infrastructure.
Nothing.
Wow.
Then the international community, by the time of the second peace agreement, largely has sort of washed its hands of the country in this very paternalistic, racist way. I think for the Americans, South Sudan was their baby, and they were going to bring their child into a mature country. But then the child threw its toys out of the pram. This is sort of language sometimes American diplomats use. Mm. So we don't want anything to do with it anymore. Actually, America's being the child there, right? Not the South Sudan.
Of course.
So then the people backing Salva are one, Museveni in Uganda, and two, Burhan in Khartoum.
Ah.
So there's really, it's regional power. So at the beginning of the war in 2013, it was Ugandan troops that stood on the road from Juba and were the last line of defense against the Nuer for Salva Kiir. It's Museveni who came in to back him to the hilt. And at the beginning of the war, Sudan reprised its old role. Mm. It backed the Nuer against the Dinka. But over time, and this is the true tragedy, Salva realized that rather than fighting for a new Khartoum, it would be better to ally with Khartoum and reproduce the racist center-periphery dynamics of the Sudanese state. So Pagan Amum, one opposition politician, jokes sometimes that we fought to have one country with a new system. Now we have two countries with the same system in both.
Wow.
And representative of this, the last detail for you, is that Salva brings in a man to be a security advisor and his general head honcho, Tukku Gatluwak, who's a Nuer, who is the adopted son of Bashir, the dictator of the north, who then becomes effectively the adopted son of Salva. And you see the recreation of the same system, the sponsorship of the militias, the exploitation of the periphery. Now it's done not on a racial basis, but on an ethnic basis. But it's the same system.
Oliver, you mentioned elite several times. And of course, it's Black History Month. One of the biggest problems in Africa is, of course, the elites and the actions and the solipsistic nature of elitism. You know, it's all self, 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 and even more self. Hang on, they're already calling. Let me just answer this call. Hello? 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 I can't hear you. Hello? Oops, line's gone. Right, so when you look at Africa, not even me, as somebody who obviously, I mean, knowing about South Sudan, you've made references to Nigeria. Given the coups that we've seen recently, you know, in the west part of Africa, and then you take, you know, you kind of stand on the, you know, parapet and take a look across Africa yourself. What do you see, Joshua, honestly, what do you see? Do you see an Africa that's trying to progress, that's been prevented by the international interferers? Or do you see an Africa that's perhaps, you know, sort of self-harming, if you like? Hold on to that. The lines are going. Hold on to that question, Joshua, because I need you to answer it. Let me just answer this call. Hello?
Good afternoon.
Good afternoon. Good afternoon. What's your name? Where are you calling from, please?
You have Emmanuel on the line. I'm calling you from Ekwe.
Go ahead, Emmanuel. What's your question?
Now, it's unfortunate what is happening in South Sudan. However, can we connect it to exploitation of mineral resources, you know, by the powerful countries?
Okay, thank you.
And if we can connect it to that, is it that the educated elite of South Sudan, is it that they can't connect one and two together, you know, to sit down and resolve the issue internally?
Okay, thank you.
To have peace, yeah, thank you.
Thank you so much. I don't know whether you heard that. Did you hear it, Joshua?
Yeah, I think so. It was about the role of external powers in terms of resources.
In terms of resources, so I'll leave you to kind of talk about the question I asked and the question Emmanuel asked.
Okay, so to come to Emmanuel's question, the oil is exploited in South Sudan by largely Malaysian and Chinese companies, which have a deal with the South Sudanese state. But it's the South Sudanese state that largely take a lot of that money. And I think it's sort of, there's an easy story to tell about foreign resources in Congo, in South Sudan, that says, look, it's about these nefarious neo-imperialist powers exploiting the country. Look, I'm a Marxist, so I like these sort of stories, but I don't think it's true here. I think the real problem is not there are external nefarious powers, it's the nature of the international system itself. So South Sudan now sells most of its oil to commodity brokers because it's broken trust with almost everybody else in the world. And it's the obscure, opaque nature of the international system, of the way finance and commodities are traded, that enables the sort of financial dictatorship that we see at the moment in South Sudan. It's not some powers manipulating South Sudan. It's South Sudan doing exactly what big corporations are doing, offshoring their money, hiding it, making the traces disappear. And I think this comes to your question, which is, of course, I think you see so many different things in Africa in general, but in the part that I know, which is the Sahel from the west to the east, which is in a place like South Sudan, you see a genuine deep desire for local voices to be heard, for democracy. And you see that being stymied by a political order which is reliant on external resources, which is reliant on a regional position, which is shamefully assisted, I think, by the African Union and by different regional bodies, IGAD, ECOWAS, whatever, you know. I think it's, in a way, and I would talk about the coups in West Africa in the same way, the French obviously have this terrible, continuous neocolonial attitude to Africa, have done to Francafrique for many years. But I think France is a cheap shot in some ways. And it's not going to be these coups are not the solution to a more general economic crisis, which is really about the forms of production that are happening in places across the Sahel and the forms of general economic immiseration. That these coups are not going to answer those questions, those basic questions about what does the future look like? Where can I get enough food to feed my family? These are, for me, the fundamental questions about what is the economic order of the Sahel look like in the coming century.
Indeed. I've got a question. It's on our WhatsApp. It says, hey, it's from Olubenga in Ikorodu. He said, I thought Salva Kiir is taken from John Kerang's philosophy after his death. I'm shocked to hear now that he's arming the child soldier to fortify himself. I have another one here. Good afternoon, Cecilia. Your guest is very right for saying that tribal differences is not the problem, but politicians who capitalize on ethnic differences to further their political campaign. This is exactly the case of Nigeria today. Our politicians are the ones causing the ethnic division in Nigeria because of their greedy and selfish political interest. Unfortunately, many Nigerians don't realize that they're being used against their fellow Nigerians. I'm sure that's music to your Marxist ears, Joshua.
Sure. I mean, I think there was a great saying that John Garang had, which was that we're going to take the town to the village, meaning we're going to generalize development outside of Khartoum to the villages. We're going to bring schools, education.
And that's
and the joke.
That's also what needs to happen in Nigeria. Take the cities to the village. It's interesting. Go on.
The joke that's said in South Sudan is instead we've taken the village to the town, meaning that we've used the ethnic divisions between villages as a way of ruling the town rather than generalizing development out of the town.
Absolutely. It's interesting. There's often a thread. And look, we've only got 15 minutes left, but you're going to be coming back, Joshua. I don't care what you said. If we have to come and kidnap you from Fairfield, New York, you're going to be coming back. But there's an interesting thread that, you know, or pattern rather, across Africa as a continent. And then I had Ken Roth here, and I'd like you to comment on that. Wonderful interview. But I said to him, I said, Ken, we're here, we are talking about, you know, what Israel is doing to Palestine, etc., etc. Nobody talks anymore about what George Bush and Blair did to the Sahel through their lies of weapons of no destruction, so to speak. And I'd like you to comment on that. But before I go, the lines have gone wild. Give me a second. Hello? Oops. You snooze, you lose. Hello? You have to call back. Joshua, I'm going to give you a moment. Just, you know, like I said, you're Sahel. You're something of an expert. What are your thoughts on that? The fact that we had Blair and Bush and what's his name? The Chief of Army Staff, the black guy. I've forgotten his to Bush.
Colin Powell.
Colin Powell, thank you. All told these lies, went to Libya, basically destroyed Libya, which has pushed terrorism in the Sahel, insurgency, all the way down and into Nigeria's north. I'd like you to comment on that. I mean, earlier this year, we had a big massacre in Plateau in Nigeria. It was insane. I'd like you to comment on that. I'll give you like 2 or 3 minutes. Go ahead.
I think that we have to look back at the 90s as this period of real Western arrogance. And like, as much as you might say there are economic interests involved, I think it's even sadder than that. I think it's real naive stupidity. It is the Samantha Power doctrine. You know, the power is now back in government. That we will intervene and we will remodel countries, and we can say that it was a spectacular failure. And all it did was make a bunch of defense companies around Virginia extremely rich.
Definitely.
And cause an enormous amount of suffering across the world. I think now, talking to American diplomats, it's sort of funny to think that on one level, they still expect the same amount of deference that they would have in that era of intervention. But I remember being in Khartoum just before the coup in 2021 and talking to a Sudanese politician and saying, well, couldn't there be a coup? Because I just talked to the Americans. They were like, there cannot be a coup. They told us there wouldn't be a coup. And this diplomat was like, what are they going to do? Invade? Right? We've just seen them leave Kabul. And I think for, you know, those Western politicians, there's a question like, what does your policy look like?
Exactly.
In the Sahel.
Exactly.
What are you doing? Because you don't have the same heft, right? Like, you're watching Russia expand its influence. France is holding on to Chad as really its last outpost of the Francafrique. And I don't think they have a sense of what they're doing. I don't think they have the bandwidth. I don't think they have the interest. I think, sadly, you're seeing really the sort of the collapse of a certain model of imperialism. Maybe happily we're seeing the collapse of a certain model of imperialism, but in the aftermath of that, one would hope that there is more room for the Sahel to define themselves, to make of themselves their own people, but they remain dominated by the financial systems. I think we're going to see, in a sad way, a rerun of the great global debt crisis of the late 70s and early 80s this decade.
Yeah.
And that's going to be absolutely destructive. It's not going to produce new states, right? Like, I think at some level, until we address, like, at some level, you know, when Fanon is writing in Wretched of the Earth, he says, fundamentally, one of the problems is that the solution to this crisis has to be reached internationally, cannot simply be dealt with at the national level, because it is about global debt, among other things. Global debt is the great neocolonial legacy. And unless we address that, and that will require America's role, because America runs that World Bank, by the way.
And that's,
you know,
the question, though.
Something has to be done.
Yeah, but that's the question. What is to be done about America itself? Because, you know, there was a conversation. Oh, my gosh, we've only got 7 minutes left. There was a conversation with, what's his name, Carlson, the guy, the journalist from America who went to see Putin, right? Tucker Carlson. Tucker Carlson goes to have a conversation with Putin all the way in Russia, which I would love to do, by the way. It becomes this whole big news. And Putin is basically saying, at the end of the day, the one country that doesn't want peace is America. Let's be honest. Do you agree?
I mean, I think Putin is running a pretty impressive war machine that also doesn't want peace fundamentally. But I think that part of America, like historically, part of America's economy has just been driven by war, right? We cannot, like, this goes back to the 1950s, the 1940s. And there are speeches about this in the 50s that America's Defense Department war machine is a fundamental part of their foreign policy. And I think one of the true things about American foreign policy is that it is a domestic concern. It's not about the rest of the world. It's always about, like, look, even the current imbroglio over funding Ukraine.
Yeah.
That has nothing to do with Ukraine.
Yeah.
The Republicans don't give a shit. It's about making, you know, Biden look bad.
Yeah.
Right? It's like every chance they get to make him look bad, from, you know, his little mistake with the president of Mexico.
Yes, Al-Sisi, you know, and like Egypt, onwards, like,
it's all domestic. That's the tragedy. I mean, I live in America, right? Like, these people don't care about the rest. They don't even have a sense of the rest of the world. It's all domestic play that plays out on the world stage to the detriment of the people of the world.
Yes, indeed.
You know, really, I think we need to reintroduce that we should vote for the president of America.
Absolutely.
It's our world without us getting a say.
Absolutely. Well, like somebody said about Israel, said Israel is not an American foreign policy. Israel is an American domestic policy. Yeah. Oh, my word. I think, have I run out of time? I've got a minute. Can I answer a quick call? Let me answer a quick call before you go. Look, I've got a message here. Somebody said that I need to get Joshua. Said, good evening, Enjoy Info. Can you please get Joshua to educate the African media and community about the selfish politicking that causes crisis and war? Thereafter, take advantage of the people. Oh, the line's gone. Okay, he's back. Let's do 2 minutes. I don't know what it is we've got. Hold on 1 second. Hello?
Hello.
Yes, quickly. Your name and your question.
Good evening.
Yes.
Yeah, good evening.
Good evening. Good evening. Yeah.
So, please, I just want to ask concerning the Hamas, right?
Yeah.
I mean, what are the Palestinians as a people, as government, doing concerning the Hamas?
We're not talking about Palestine. We're talking about Africa. You haven't been listening to me. Bye.
Okay.
Bye.
You know,
what?
But you know, the IDF now, they are saying that...
Yeah, but we're not talking about the IDF. We are talking about Africa. Hello.
Hello, good afternoon, ma.
Good afternoon. What's your name? Where are you calling from?
This is someone on the line. I want to ask.
You want to ask Joshua? Go ahead, ask.
Yes, I want to ask Joshua that seeing all these things, this is a tribal war that the politicians are causing in this country, and the war continued. Please, how do we curb it?
How do we curb tribal wars? Okay.
Yes.
Good one. Thank you.
All right, politicians. So
thank you.
Have a headway.
Thank you. I've only got 4 minutes, so I want to drag in one more question. All the lines are going now. Hello? Oops, you snooze, you lose. Hello?
Hello, Ireti.
Yes, good afternoon.
Yeah, Ireti Bakari. Let me call you. Ireti Bakari Yusuf.
Yes, please. Go ahead. Question, quickly.
I want to ask our guest, the former SPLA leader who died in the plane crash, John Garang.
Yes.
Had he been alive today, does he think South Sudan would have been in this problem after the independence
Excellent. Good question. Did you hear that? Excellent question. I really have intelligent listeners, even though they tend to fight with me over the mic. And the other question, is how can we curb, you know, tribal wars or the politicians using tribal politics to divide us? I'm going to give you, what, 2 minutes? Has he got 2 minutes? You've got 2 minutes. Over to you.
Just 2 minutes to solve all the problems of South Sudan.
Absolutely.
I mean, I think, you know, to the politicians in Juba aren't stupid, and a lot of them aren't even evil. They are using the resources they have available, and I don't think we should demonize them.
Mm.
They'd stop using those resources if there was another possibility on the table, right? So if there was not a system in which external flows of money came to Salva and Salva dispersed them like the big banker in the sky to the most violent guy, to the guy who has the biggest militia on the ground. If that's your system, of course they're going to mobilize on the basis of ethnicity.
Mm.
Right? Because who is going to be most loyal to you? My family, my kinsmen.
That's right.
They're just responding to an incentive system. You have to change that incentive system. You have to have massive reform of the actual global financial system and the global oil system. I mean, I think it would be much better for South Sudan, honestly, as a political country, if there was no oil. Get rid of all the oil.
We hear that so often. It appears to Nigeria, it appears to Ghana. Their problems didn't start till they found oil, etc., etc. You've got to come back, Joshua, but go ahead. I want you to answer that question about what's his name, Garang. That, yes.
Yeah, so I don't know, because Garang himself was also a pretty dictatorial Stalinist for a lot of his regime. And we shouldn't, I obviously respect and greatly venerate the man, but we shouldn't sort of falsely turn him into a saint. I suspect that the divisions and the way the system was set up from the beginning in 2005 was such that probably something similar would have happened unless Garang had continued the war for Khartoum.
Yeah.
Because I think really you can say with the diplomats in 2005, look, we got what we could, South Sudan. But look, from the perspective of 2024, we have a terrible civil war in Sudan. We have basically a civil war in South Sudan. What have we gained from the independence of South Sudan?